The Guardian.
Welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the UEFA Nations League. England lose to Spain. Here's an original question. Are they missing that one creative midfielder? Meanwhile, how long will Gareth Southgate stay as his contract talks stall? The Welsh beat Ireland but can't cope with real Danish footballers, while Scotland have a bad time with Belgium. Also today, we have an actual real-life footballer in the studio, so we'll ask, what's it like being an actual real-life footballer? Add to that conference sides going to Scotland, your questions, feedback corner, and that is today's Guardian Football Weekly. Good morning, Barry Glendenning.
Good morning, Max Rushton. How are you?
Can I confirm you are not an actual real-life footballer?
You can.
Okay. Andy Brassel, nice to see you.
Good morning, nice to see you.
Can I confirm you are not an actual real-life footballer?
Pinterest pause. Yes, you may.
Marcus Bean, how are you?
Good, thanks, Max.
I can confirm, are you an actual real-life footballer?
Yes, I am.
You are. You play for Wycombe Wanderers.
That's right, yeah, Wycombe Wanderers.
Question one, why are you not at training? It's 20-11.
Good question. Basically, I get Mondays off as part of my contract to do a bit of work with Toka Football, which I'm involved in. Some of the boys aren't happy about it, but so be it, yeah.
Oh, really? So you went in with the gaffer and you said, I'm not doing Mondays?
Basically, yeah. Don't get me wrong. They cut my wages a little bit, but yeah, they did.
This is what players are discussing when they're thrashing out the personal terms.
Yeah. You were going to be on the pod a couple of weeks ago, but you couldn't because Wycombe got through the first round of the Carabao Cup.
That's right, yeah. So if we've got a game on Tuesday, I'm in with the rest of the boys training. And now we're in the third round. Norwich at home. So looking forward to it.
So does that mean you were pretty sure you weren't going to get through the first round of the Carabao Cup?
No, I just didn't check when the next second round was going to be. That was the main thing.
Oh, I like that. So the game's just a surprise to you when they come out. It's exciting. Yeah. All right, well, we're going to get part three is entitled, What's It Like to Be a Footballer, Marcus? And you are, I like to think of myself as a footballer, but we'll probably ask you the questions mainly in that. But otherwise, just pile in with the rest of us. We've had some UEFA Nations League, Andy, haven't we? What do we think of it?
It's been really good. And I think it's been everything that everyone hoped for so far. Meaningful international football, which especially on the back of such a positive World Cup is a really good thing. I was at England-Spain on Saturday night, and I just think the level of engagement there was with the fans, obviously some of that's a hangover from the World Cup, a nice hangover from the World Cup. But the fact that both teams were really into it, it makes an enormous difference. It's funny, when you go back over the friendlies over the last week, like, you know, I think Portugal versus Croatia, you know, the European champions against the last World Cup finalists, pretty dull. Scotland versus Belgium, you know, not amazing. The friendlies now stick out like a sore thumb. But the fact that they're the minority rather than, you know, you still get, I've still had a couple of people on my Twitter timeline moaning about what's the point of international breaks, why don't they have them all at the end of the season, etc., etc. But that sort of traffic, I think, is discernibly lower than it normally would be in an international break, especially in one this early in the season.
Barry?
Yeah, I think it's been a huge success, and you kind of wonder, why didn't they think of it before? The games are being played with an intensity that you just don't see in friendlies, and you can't help but feel if that England-Spain match, for example, had been a friendly rather than with something at stake, however little, that it would have fizzled out into nothing towards the end of the second half. There would have been mass substitutions and everyone had got lost interest, you know, players
well,
and fans.
Got given.
Well, yeah, that too. But I think I've watched four different Nations League games and they've all been good in their own ways. Wales-Ireland obviously was a thrashing for Ireland, which was quite disappointing, but I was very impressed with Wales, you know. So teams are trying and players are putting in a huge effort. Well, not a huge effort, but they are trying, which is more than you normally get from international friendlies.
It's the first time England have lost three games in a row since Euro 88, Marcus. Are you saying Southgate out?
No, far from it. I've been impressed with Southgate, and in fact, I've been impressed with the FA in the way that they've tried to change the English game, trying to play football through the thirds, etc. And I think you need to give Southgate time to keep developing that.
It's interesting because his contract is stalling. So there's a wonder, does he want the time, or do you think he's sort of looking at this and going, am I ever going to take England further than I took them at the World Cup? What do you think?
I think given the time, he will. I think if you look at the youth teams and the producing good footballers, I think there are issues in the team with the midfield, the lack of creativity, lack of a holding midfielder that can dictate play. And I think if he finds one of those, a little gem inside in one of the under-23s or 21s, sorry, etc., then I think he can really take the team on.
That is the big question, though. Can he find one, Andy? I mean, lots of names are thrown about, from Harry Winks to Jonjo Shelvey to Lewis Cook to James Maddison. Mm-hmm. None of them are Andrea Pirlo or Sergio Busquets.
No, but I think in terms of like that creative midfielder, I don't think we want to be sat here getting massively hung up on where's the number 10. English football doesn't produce number 10s. What's the point in us sitting around talking about
that? But it's not a 10, though, is it? Is it a 10? We need a 10, or we need a holding midfielder who can also keep
pass
the ball?
That is asking for a lot. That is asking for a lot, asking for a Busquets from nowhere. I mean, that's the thing with Jordan Henderson. If you think of his very debut against France, someone tried to shoehorn him into that role at the beginning, and it, you know, it made it very difficult for him. It made it the beginning of his international career a bit of an uphill climb. As for creativity a little further forward, I mean, I suppose the obvious one that people will be watching is Jadon Sancho, because he's at a good club already, that he's making a dent, that he can make a dent off the bench. I would be really surprised if he continued on his current way if he didn't end up in the squad for Euro 2020. I'd expect him to be a regular more often than not at Dortmund by then. I think Marcus is right. We just have to be a little bit patient. I mean, the fact that we got to the semi-finals of the World Cup doesn't necessarily mean England are the fourth best team in the world. And, you know, you have to take that as a pleasant surprise and then like carry on. I think that's always been the problem, hasn't it, with English football, that after every tournament, there has to be, you know, almost a rethink. This is the first time in a while, because we've done so well at the tournament, that there isn't a rethink, that there isn't a let's start again. Well, if you start again every 2 years or every 4 years, that's a terrible idea. You know, you need to be patient. Germany were patient from getting from the low point of Euro 2000 to winning the World Cup in 2014. It takes time.
In your experience as a player, have you found clubs patient? Have you found fans patient?
No. Fans aren't patient, obviously. They want instant success. I suppose, generally, these things take time, as I said before, and the England fans need to be patient. If they're not, then we're going to get the same old thing where we'll be a second rate in a national team.
It's interesting, Barry, because I was there, and I don't know if you thought this as well, Andy, you were there. There were lots of kids there that were so enthusiastic. And I was looking at them thinking, oh, you know, kids are enthusiastic about stuff. But also, they haven't been burnt like England football fans. You know, their England football team is a successful football team.
Yeah, but they will be burned. And probably sooner rather than later. I mean, people are going to be cross at me for saying this, but let's not forget, England's path to the semi-final was quite easy in the World Cup. You know, it's difficult to imagine, or I certainly can't remember any team getting an easier run to the semi-final. There probably is, but I can't think of one. But, you know, they did quite well. But I think the goodwill they've bought at the World Cup is now over. You know, they lost against Spain, and if they lose another game, I think fans will start to get impatient again, because England fans, like football fans all over the place, are not renowned for their patience.
The game itself, Luke Shaw, until his injury, started well. That pass for Rashford
was just a wonderful pass. Mm. I don't think he quite got the credit he deserved for it. I was sort of on my feet going, wow, brilliant.
And the defending was a bit disappointing for Spain's goals from an England perspective. I look at Southgate, Andy, and I think there's a ruthlessness to him. Dropping Kyle Walker, I thought, wow, that's quite bold, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, and you know, you think he's moved on from some of the elder elements of the squad as well. But I think, you know, when you look down the amount of caps that are in the first 11 and even beyond that, there's not a huge lot of experience. That's why you have to be patient. And you know what? I'm not sure I disagree with Barry about like it just being the end of the honeymoon. I felt from the atmosphere that people were, that goodwill is still there. I think even if, like, England, and I know there are a lot of things to worry about in life already, even if England, relegation battlers England, go down from their UEFA Nations League group, I think there's something that people understand just from the way he is with people. I think he buys himself time. He buys himself goodwill. The way he's been willing to connect with the nation. I didn't sense England. Of course, there were some people booing when it got to the end and England didn't win. But I didn't really sense that people were like, oh, here we go again, or anything like that. I didn't feel that at all.
Ali says, since England are now in danger of relegation from the Nations League, do we sack Southgate and get Allardyce in until the end of the season? I wonder, you mentioned the way he relates to fans. You must have had managers who were very good at relating to the fans and managers who were very bad at it.
Mm. Yeah, no, definitely.
Name names.
No names. But I do think Southgate has got that real connection with the fans, and for him, it's going to buy him that little bit more time as well. I think if, for example, Sam Allardyce was in charge, rubbing people up the wrong way, you wonder how long he'd last. But I think that connection's important and something we've been missing, I think, for a while.
Well, Marcus, you played under Ian Holloway, who I think is interesting because I've never met the guy. Well, I have been in the same room as him, but I wouldn't claim to know him. But I'm a fan of his, but he seems to polarise fans. Some hate him, some love him.
He polarises not just fans, but players as well. Some players will say a lot of what he does is an act. And some players will say, you know, they love him. So it's a difficult one with Ian Holloway. I was a fan of him. He gave me my debut. I've got a tremendous amount of respect for him. But he did actually sometimes, I felt, play up to that whole persona.
We got on Soccer AM in the glory years. We filmed him making an entire chicken coop. And then when he got to the Premier League, he said, I don't want to do that sort of thing anymore. We were very disappointed. Leicester's Harry Maguire signed a new 5-year deal. Interestingly, Chilwell's come into the squad for this Leicester game. Damari Gray as well. England haven't sold all their tickets and it's at Leicester. And I just wonder, is Ian Marshall just there cleaning his boots? Matt Elliott going, I could get a game here.
I'll pay for Claridge.
Yeah, absolutely. Claridge could get in. You don't even need to buy any new shin pads for Claridge, do you? Moving on, Wales 4, Ireland.
Sorry, did you say Matt Elliott there?
Oh, he did play for Scotland, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's true. When I said it, I did think that, but...
Lazy journalism, Matt.
Yes, but he's more English than me, isn't he? Let's be honest. Wales 4, don't come and find me, Matt, just in case. Wales 4, Ireland 1. Did you enjoy this, Barry?
I did not enjoy it one bit. It was incredibly depressing. There are extenuating circumstances for Ireland. They were missing a few players, but the future for them looks so bleak. I think they've got a management team who increasingly resemble, you know, that Simpsons newspaper clipping, old man shouts at cloud. The structure in Ireland of youth development is prehistoric. They had no answers for a Wales team who clearly had a new lease of life under Ryan Giggs. And I listened to Elliot James and
Elliot. Your new best friend. We're not editing that out.
I listened to Ellis James and Ian Roberts enthuse about it on their podcast, and they were so excited about this new dawn of Welsh football that I couldn't help but titter up my sleeve when Denmark did them in the following game. But Wales were absolutely outstanding against Ireland, but the thing is, they might as well have been playing some training cones. Ireland offered nothing. If nothing else, they're supposed to be defensively solid. They've now conceded 9 goals in 2 competitive games against Denmark and Wales. But, you know, you look at the Wales team, Ben Davis, Chris Meffham, Conor Roberts, Ethan Ampadu, Tom Lawrence, Gareth Bale, Joe Allen, all outstanding. Ethan Ampadu, particularly for a 17-year-old kid, was mightily impressive. It annoys me he could have declared for Ireland. But, I don't know if there was ever a chance of that, but we certainly won't get him now, and we could do with him. And too many Irish players are failing to deliver. Ryan Giggs had 9 players younger than Ireland's youngest player in his squad. And I think it'll be a long time before Ireland are qualifying for anything, and exciting times for Wales. But yeah, I did snicker when they got beaten by Denmark. Yeah.
Some Irish players apparently haven't turned up, Marcus, because of their relationship with Roy Keane. I don't know if you've ever crossed paths with Roy.
No, but I've heard some interesting stories. Clinton Morrison used to tell me a few of those when he was in the Irish squad with him. He's a very lively character by all accounts.
from what I've heard, and I have, seems to be a bit of a circus in the Irish squad at the moment, and I think Ireland were wrong to give O'Neill and Keane new contracts before they failed to qualify for the World Cup, and I think their partnership just seems to be stale. It's not working, and whether or not the FAI can afford to get rid of them remains to be seen. But if Ireland don't up their game considerably very quickly, public affection for them is wearing very thin.
Does anybody know what Martin O'Neill said to Ryan Giggs at the end of that game? It is a hilarious clip, isn't it? Where the full-time whistle goes, they shake hands. And Ryan Giggs looks sort of surprised most of the time. Anyway, he's got the sort of beady eye, wide-eyed sort of gawp, hasn't he? Sort of naturally. But it did. It sort of looked like Martin O'Neill said, you know,
I know what you did last summer.
Or like, you know, I've just infected you with an airborne disease and you have 30 seconds left to live. Because he was just sort of looking around, looking totally flummoxed.
The consensus seems to be he was looking to see where Roy Keane was because he hadn't shook hands with his former teammate and Keane had disappeared off down the tunnel.
So Wales then went on, as you say, to lose 2-0 to Denmark. Christian Eriksen was the difference in that game. When you watch a player like Christian Eriksen, what do you see, Marcus?
I see a player that's got great spatial awareness and extremely good technique. He nearly scored a hat trick in that game. Watched parts of it. Just goes to show how poor Ireland were, because I thought Denmark were dominant in that game. So as you said, I think Ireland got big problems, but Eriksen's a world class player, and you know, someone that England could do with.
It's interesting, isn't it, with someone like Eriksen, because he isn't that quick, and he isn't that strong, but he's just got time on the ball.
Yeah, no, exactly. He just knows where everybody is, and he might manage to find pockets of space. And also, what he's got is an extremely good first touch, which buys him more time. So that's why he looks like he's got so much time on the ball.
Because you're really good at football, right? Do you look at him? Is that a different game?
Yeah, it's a different game. I think those guys, the elite players, the world-class players, which I kind of put him in, they're playing a different game. And a lot of it's not due down to technique. It's about footballing IQ. They're just two or three steps ahead of everybody else.
Do you think he's sitting at home thinking, if I had half a yard more pace, I think he's thinking a level up from that.
I agree. I think if he had half a yard pace, he'd be in the brackets of the Neymars and the Hazards, etc. And a bit like Harry Kane, I think if he had an extra yard of pace, he'd be thinking the same thing. I think Eriksen's good enough to play for anybody in the world.
Nicholas Bentner was arrested, reported to police by a Copenhagen taxi driver who claims the Danish footballer was behind a violent attack on Sunday morning. The taxi driver has undergone surgery for a broken jaw. That's according to the taxi firm Dantaxa. A source told Sky Sports News Bentner was arrested. Contrary to some reports, has not been charged. That'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start with Scotland 0, Belgium 4. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. More live shows coming up after that huge success in Manchester, Barry, the 19th of September. What's that, next Wednesday? We're at the Rockefeller in Oslo.
Woohoo.
Me, you, Wilson and Lars. And then a new date has been announced, 29th of November, the Emmanuel Centre in London. Me, you, Wilson, and one more, TBC. Marcus, Andy, you interested?
I'm in.
You're in? Yeah, this is going to be a really tough, like, part two and three now, isn't it?
The pressure's on as to who we pick between the two of you. Scotland 0, Belgium 4. Andy, can we take any positives for the Scots?
I didn't think they were that bad, honestly, against a team that we know has got an enormous amount of talent compared to them. I didn't really think it was a 4-0 game. And again, I think it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. Like, the friendliness of it completely skews where it was, but I think just the individual quality made the difference, and it made it look a lot worse than it was on paper than in reality.
Some of the goals were a little bit Sunday league, weren't they?
They were awful. Just losing the ball in your own third like that, and just waltzing in. They're basically walking the ball into the net. It's unacceptable at that level. I think, yeah, Scotland have got to go back to the drawing board and look at about how they play, because it's all well and good trying to play from the back, but you have to have the players to do it.
Can you forgive them in a friendly, or do you think you should say, listen, this is how good we are, we shouldn't be doing this?
No, I don't think that's unforgivable, some of those mistakes, you know, not being aware of what's around you. If someone's up your, coming from behind, you've got to pop the ball back, you know, just turning into trouble. They're basic things. And I think Scott McLeish has got a big task on his hand there.
Alex
McLeish, sorry.
Oh, Scott McLeish.
He's
a great centre-forward.
Great centre-forward. Wickham as well. Yeah.
Scored a lot of goals, McLeish?
So. McLeish, he's had five games in charge. They've all been friendlies and they've only won one, I think, away at Hungary and scored one goal. He's already under pressure. And he himself has said, sort of cited Michael O'Neill at Northern Ireland and the Russian manager, Cheryshev, as managers who started, got off to a slow start, but are now sort of lauded in Northern Ireland and Russia, respectively. But he needs a result against Albania. You know, he said, now we start now, we draw a line and we start now. This is our first competitive game. He's determined to play three at the back, play it out from the back. And, you know, it's... You can't really hold him accountable for individual errors, but Kieran Tierney, say, for example, is playing in the back three, and then he's, I think it's James Forrest and Andy Robertson are his wing backs. So, I mean, I think on paper, as I said on Thursday, there's a lot of quality in that Scotland squad, but he needs a result or he's going to be under serious pressure.
I mean, they created chances in that game, didn't they? Against a decent Belgian side. I think for Belgium going forward, you wonder like where the next generation of defence is. I mean, really, like for all the nations we've talked about in the Nations League, you could argue this is potentially the biggest for them. You know, they are at that point now where we can't talk about them as a young team. They have to really get on with it and fulfil that potential. And, you know, we talked about England building on what they did at the World Cup. I think that counts double for Belgium. The pressure is on them to do it a lot quicker, I think.
Do you think it was right for them to have the big open top bus thing when they came third in the World Cup, Belgium? It's very different to how England returned home.
I'm not a big fan of celebrating third places, to be honest. I think winners, runners-up... possibly runners up, but yeah, finishing third I think is yeah, it means nothing really, to be honest.
I suppose it depends what's expected of you, really. I mean, when Ireland got to the quarterfinals of the World Cup the first time they qualified, yeah, there was like 500,000 out to greet the team when they came home because no one expected them to get that far. But you know, Belgium were realistic contenders to win the World Cup, came up short. Is it, yeah, it's not really,
but it's, if you look at the way that they went out of the last couple of tournaments, I went out with a whimper against Wales in Euro 2016, against Argentina in the 2014 World Cup. I think there's a sense of progress. And do you know what? I don't see why they shouldn't celebrate. This thing, I find it so annoying in finals when, you know, the players go up to collect their medals. They get a silver medal and no one wants, like, it's like the thing around your neck is made of lava or something. You've got to take it off.
But that's the elite
away.
That's the elite sports mentality. You know, you lose, the elite sportsmen grieve after a defeat.
I think it's a learned reaction. I think it's a learned reaction that's come in more and more over the past 4 or 5 years. People didn't do that 10 years ago. It's become a thing. I tell you what, when I went to the Europa League final in, I guess it must have been 2012, between Atletico Madrid and Athletic Bilbao. I mean, you might remember it because it was Marcelo Bielsa's Athletic. And I've never seen such a set of players destroyed by defeat in a final. There was no learned reaction there. They were absolutely devastated. He didn't really deal with the aftermath of it all that well, but that's a different story. But one of the most striking things I think I've ever seen after a match is that all the players came out and they're all very red-eyed. They'd all been crying pretty much without exception. And after all the players had come out, the press officer from Athletic, he came out just with a clutch of 20 silver medals in his hand. They'd all left them in the dressing room. I found that amazing.
From my point of view, I've been to Wembley twice. I think one in a Checker Trade Trophy, which was called the Johnson's Paint then, sorry, and in a playoff final. And both occasions have been probably the worst times in my career. People say playing at Wembley's great, etc., which it is, but they're two moments in my career I want to forget. And for me, finishing second, it means nothing at that stage. You know, you got a silver medal, which is great, yeah. But
do you keep them?
I don't even know where they are.
Really?
That's the honest God's honest truth. I don't know where they are. The promotion medals, I know where they are, but the silver medals or the runners-up medals, I don't know where they are. I think for elite sportsmen, winning is everything. And not until maybe 10, 20 years down the line do you appreciate the moment, I think. And the moment I still don't appreciate playing at Wembley, if that makes sense.
Wow.
Northern Ireland 1, Bosnia 2. You were impressed with Northern Ireland, Barry, weren't you?
I was very impressed, and I still can't figure out how they lost because they dominated almost for 90 minutes, and two lapses in concentration cost them dearly. But they can take a huge amount of positives from the game. They roared out of the traps. They were very intense with it. You know, Bosnia obviously came to Windsor Park with a plan to play out from the back, which they abandoned within 5 minutes because they couldn't settle on the ball. They weren't given a second to settle on the ball. Weirdly, Robert Prosinecki is the Bosnia-Herzegovina manager. He only brought four defenders in his squad.
It's cavalier.
And it turned out that one of them was actually suspended. He had a suspension from under 21 level, which they didn't think applied to senior, but it turns out it did. So he had to field a fella at left back who wasn't used to playing left back, and he got absolutely roasted. Eldar Sivic was his name, and he was given a very torrid time. But, you know, Ireland or Northern Ireland lost the game, but I would be very pleased if I was a Northern Ireland fan with the level of performance. Their tactic is, you know, intense pressing, move the ball quickly and get crosses in from the flanks, and they were just lacking that little bit of clinical finishing up front. You know, they should have scored a few goals. They were also denied a penalty in the first minute, which, if it had been given, I think would have led to a completely different result. They could have absolutely battered Bosnia.
France had a goalless draw with Germany on Thursday night, and then they won 2-1 against the Netherlands. Chris says, Ryan Babel scored against France. Do you and the rest of the pod feel you've got enough credit for seeing this coming so far in advance? Andre says, he hasn't been mentioned for a while. Return of the Babel. Hashtag Babel to the future. He had wonderful hair out there, Ryan Babel, yeah. Didn't he?
He did. Made me think of Jamie Lawrence, who used to play for Bradford.
Merce tells a good Jamie Lawrence story. I think it's Jamie Lawrence, where that Merce had a game on a... there was an away game on a Saturday, and Merce didn't want to play. So he said to Jamie Lawrence, I'll run down the wing, just nudge me, I'll go over, and then I'll just say I've got a knock and I'll miss the game. So Merce starts running down the wing, and Jamie Lawrence just launches himself two-footed at Merce, puts him out for 2 months, and then wanders over to Merce and goes, was that all right, Paul? Merce goes, yeah, couldn't move. What did you make of that France win, Andy?
You know what? They weren't at their absolute best, but I suppose you could say that for a lot of the World Cup as well. The way they played in Germany in the first Nations League game, it's funny, they only had one change from the team that won the World Cup final in goal because Hugo Lloris wasn't fit, where Alphonse Areola played his first game in goal. And he was terrific. You know, he was their best player. France still had chances to win it, but I think... when you think it's almost exactly a year since they last played the Netherlands at the Stade de France in a World Cup qualifier, and they absolutely hammered the Netherlands that night, and the gap was appreciably smaller, which is obviously good news for Ronald Koeman. But yeah, I think there's still this feeling that's kind of being postponed because, of course, it was the first time they played at home since they won the World Cup. It was a big celebration. They had a huge presentation afterwards with all the players coming out with the trophy and larking about and all the rest of it, a light show worthy of the Parc des Princes. But almost the fact that they kind of made very heavy weather of the win, it's been totally glossed over, really.
Rafael van der Vaart, Marcus, on Dutch TV, said, the worst player on the pitch scored the winner. It's unbelievable. It's still a lovely finish from Giroud, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a beautiful finish, yeah. To be fair, he wasn't great at the World Cup either, was he? Let's be honest. I know they won it and etc. But I think it didn't have no shots on target, was it? I can't remember, something like that. But listen, France, for me, deservedly won it. Obviously, in the final, Croatia, I thought, were the better team. But overall, I think France were very good and deserved the win. But generally, I think I've watched some of the celebrations. I thought they were quite good. Those French players definitely know how to celebrate.
Yeah, Giroud gets a... But I mean, he was important, though, wasn't he? He might have had a great World Cup, but they tried it with Dembélé and the three, and it didn't work. And they need... Sometimes you need a player who isn't as good, I guess.
Yeah.
But offers different things.
Yeah, he does, but I don't think he brought his A game to the table. I think Giroud's got great touch, great feel for the ball, holds the ball up really well. He was just turned into some sort of batting ram for them, which I suppose did create some space for other players, but he wasn't at his very best and what the Giroud we know and love at Arsenal, etc.
Switzerland, who England play on Tuesday, beat Iceland 6-0. Our man in Iceland, Maggie Mart-Einarsson, says the four best players apart from Gylfi were missing, and a new coach. Easy game against Belgium on Tuesday, he says. Mo Salah scored twice and got two assists and missed two penalties as Egypt beat Niger 6-0 in a 2019 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier.
You've played international football for Jamaica.
That's right, yeah. Made one appearance with them.
Briefly, yeah.
Briefly, very briefly.
What is it? How different is it from sort of the bread and butter of
League One and Two? And I think the technical ability of the players is beyond that of in League One and Two. I played against Honduras, and just the quality of even players like that who probably aren't really renowned in an international scene just stood out for me. It just goes to show the level is definitely a couple of steps up from what I'm used to.
And just the experience of travelling to play and meeting up with people you may not know very well.
That was a really tough thing, the travel. That plane journey, straight off the plane, I had to go and train, jet lag, etc., trying to adjust to the time zones. I think it's all very difficult, and I definitely take my hat off to players that do that on a regular basis.
Zinedine Zidane is apparently waiting for the phone call, according to reports from Manchester United. Players he wants to bring in: Toni Kroos, Thiago, James Rodriguez, Edison Cavani. What do you reckon to this nonsense, Andy? Must be, mustn't it?
Well, I think the players coming in is probably nonsense, because he had no record really for team building at Real Madrid. It was about sort of looking after the superstars that he already had and getting the best out of them. He wasn't in favour of getting rid of his guys or getting new guys in. So the idea that he'd lead some sort of revolution, and especially once, you know, you think of Ed Woodward wasn't keen on getting Aldo Varel in. He's not going to be keen on breaking the bank for Edison Cavani. He's nearly 32, is he? I think it's not impossible, of course, Zinedine Zidane arriving at Manchester United. It's just a beautiful daydream, though, isn't it? You know, when you've been trudging through a very disappointing beginning to the Premier League season. Oh, wouldn't it be great, you know?
Marcus, what's your overview of Jose's season so far at United?
It's just one mess up to another, really. I think he's struggling massively. He doesn't look like he's in love with the game anymore. I remember Jose at Chelsea, etc. He had an aura about him. You could see he loved it. He just doesn't look like the same man. I think for Zidane, though, going to United at this stage could really tarnish his legacy. I think there's a huge rebuilding job to be done there. Hundreds of millions of pounds that need to be spent for him to catch up the likes of catch Man City, even Liverpool, and I think are quite a long distance ahead of them. And I don't know if Zidane, he hasn't really got experience at doing that.
I mean, it's hard for Zidane to go anywhere, really, isn't it? If he wants to, you know, anything he does next may be not as good as what he's previously done.
Yeah, that's very true. That's true. But I think Man United are a club in a little bit of a crisis at the moment. They have no identity, so he's got to go and build that. They don't have the players, in my opinion, to really have a go at the Champions League or the league. So you're right. But on the other hand, I think, yeah, that is one real, real huge task.
I mean, a lot of the football at Real Madrid, it seems like trite to say after they won three Champions League, was pretty ordinary, wasn't it? You know, there was some really dull football in there. I think what Marcus was saying about Manchester United lacking that identity, a lot of their fans feel that identity should be attacking football. I ain't necessarily going to get that with Zinedine Zidane. I mean, it's a beautiful name. I mean, it's like Thierry Henry going to Bordeaux. You don't really know what you're going to get at the end of it, but it's just, you know, a lovely thought when you're not really going anywhere.
Just in the same way as you could, at the end of last season, you just knew Jack Wilshere would end up at West Ham. You just know Zinedine Zidane. I can see him there on the Old Trafford sideline. It'll happen. Not saying it'll happen anytime soon. It may do, but it will happen.
None of us predicted John Terry signing for Spartak Moscow.
No.
On the other hand, Barry.
Which is apparently good news for Robert Huth, who may now be thrown a career lifeline by Aston Villa, who seemed determined to sign an ageing war horse with a Premier League winner's medal.
Matt Elliott is getting the call, isn't he?
Well, he's being handsomely remunerated. Why not?
1.8 million after tax. Is that what you're getting at Wickham, Marcus?
I wish.
Well, slightly less because he doesn't do Mondays.
Yeah. apparently, it all came out thanks to Antonio Conte. Spartak's manager, Massimo Carrero, was Conte's assistant with Italy and Juve, phoned him to ask about John Terry. As producer Jonathan says, we're not sure what you needed to know about, you know, is he good? Yeah. Is he a bit past his best? Yeah. How long is this phone call?
But it's interesting how Carrera himself ended up at Spartak. It was sort of very unusual. He ended up going there as an assistant because basically when Antonio Conte arrived at Chelsea, he was told he had the space for X amount of backroom staff, and Carrera was the odd one out. He couldn't fit him in. So he ended up going to Spartak as an assistant. They being quite a combustible club, sacked their coach three games into the season, and he ended up becoming the coach. And despite not speaking any Russian and sort of having arrived there by default, he went on to win the league. So it's a really roundabout way that John Terry's ended up going there. But of course, one of the presidential candidates for Sporting in Portugal had said part of his ticket was, he said, if I'm voted in, Madeira Rodriguez, then I will bring John Terry. And that they knew each other, they had a dialogue going. So it wasn't simply hot air, but he dropped out of the presidential race before the vote happened at the weekend. So that sort of put the kibosh on that. And I guess that must have broken John's heart, because it would have been the best extended golfing holiday ever.
Barry, I'd really love to get your thoughts on this sad news.
So just one thing. Yes. It is definitely you. I've been studying you. The Phantom Breeder, it is you.
The thing is, right?
It is you.
I was watching you.
Because I'm so self-conscious about it.
I was watching you yesterday on the wireless. I don't know if you're different or I just do more talking on the radio, but it was you yesterday. I could just see you sort of wheezing through your nose right into the microphone. Maybe it's different. But I did actually, in part one, inhale quite loudly. Marcus, one of us breathes on the pod. We're not allowed to breathe. It's a big problem. How dare you, Barry?
No.
Yeah, do you know what? I think it might be me on this because I do more listening. So,
okay. Anyway, I'm desperately trying not to breathe.
Barry, Adil Rami and Pamela Anderson have broken up, apparently. Apparently, Rami proposed to Pamela Anderson. She said no and left him.
Well, I feel for Adil then. That must be quite a crushing blow if he loved her enough to propose and then to... I hope he didn't do it publicly, you know, in a restaurant.
Not at half-time.
Or at half-time with a mascot getting involved or, you know. But, it's never nice to see, you know, young love or middle-aged to young-ish love flounder. And my heart goes out to Adil.
That's beautiful, beautifully spoken. And there were no breaths within that. We wish you well, Adil. And Pamela too. You know, it's hard on both sides.
It was quite an odd couple, but, you know, they clearly had something going.
At halftime in the Checker Trade game at Charlton last week, there was a proposal. She said yes. Have you ever had that at a game you've been at?
No, I've never had that before. No,
okay. It's a first. You didn't propose to Mrs. Bean. I don't know if there is a Mrs. Bean.
Yeah, I didn't propose. No, I've done that in the sanctuary of my own home. Yeah.
Okay, good. Very wise, very wise.
Well, it's pretty much the same doing it at a Checker Trade Trophy. Just in front of your loved ones.
That'll do for part two. In part three, what's it like being a real-life actual footballer? We'll ask Marcus Bean. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Marcus, your life as a footballer, you went down 3-2 at Charlton at the weekend. You were an unused substitute. Were you kicking the dressing room door? Were you warming up in front of the manager to catch his eye, to get on?
No. I think as you get older, I'm 34 now, going on 35. I think you don't get so wound up about these sort of things. You're able to keep your emotions in check. If a younger Marcus Beam would have been banging on the door on a Monday morning if I was in, saying, play me, why aren't I playing, etc. But now, you know, you kind of understand a little bit from the manager's point of view the sort of problems he had in team selection, so you let him off.
You were mentioned on the pod last season. You scored your first goal for Wickham in your 104th appearance, a 96th minute winner in a 4-3 epic against Carlisle, was named goal of the season. There was an article written for the club website written, I was there when Beanie scored, with stories from fans from the crowd. The funniest bit of that story is what, Marcus?
So I've scored, 96 winner, took off sprinting down the line like Usain Bolt trying to find my parents in a stadium, and they left early.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when we talk about footballers and we were talking about, you know, I had a one going out with Pamela Anderson, and we talk about Premier League footballers and the amount of money that they're on, and the life of a League One, League Two footballer is markedly different, isn't it?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think a League One, League Two footballer, you're playing, you're living year by year, or year, maybe 2 years. Some of these players have got 5-6 years contracts on huge amounts of money. It's a completely different world, and we kind of get labelled or thrown in with the Premiership boys, so we're all footballers, but there's different levels to it.
Were you absolutely the best player in your class at school?
In my class, probably. In my school, probably. But in my youth team, no, there were better players than me. But I had the dedication, the will to win, and, you know, I didn't get distracted. And those three or four things I mentioned there are key for any young footballer who wants to make it.
And did any of the others make it in your youth team?
No, they all fell by the wayside. There was one player, who Brian Fitzgerald, who to this day is probably one of the best footballers I played with. He was unbelievable. Man United came down trying to get him to go out there, but he just didn't really have that, you know, that will to sacrifice everything, leave family and go and do it. And that's something that I have, and that's why I got where I am.
That seems remarkable, though, to have the ability, but not that fussed, you know. It just seems extraordinary.
That seems remarkable to fans, but you know, everyone has that in every job, don't they?
No, I think you're spot on. I think that's where people sometimes get mixed up. Footballers are human beings, and in any job, you know, you get angry with a manager, if he's your work manager, he can demotivate you, he can motivate you. You know, that will to work, some people just haven't got it in any life, walk of life, and it's no different in football, and we've got to just remember that we are all human beings.
Marcus, the thing that I find interesting, when you were talking about the pressure, really, to make your livelihood if you're only on like one or two-year contracts, as a fan of a club out of the same division as you, Wimbledon, what I find remarkable is because you have this huge turnover of players each year. You know, we have eight in, eight out, or around that amount. And, you know, when you... Are the players aware of the chat on the message boards when someone comes in? And it's always extraordinary. I don't know what people expect, but a striker will come in and say, oh, his goal record's not very good. I looked him up on Wikipedia, and you're kind of thinking, well, we're a League One team. What are you expecting? Do you have a sense of that expectation as a player?
A little bit. I think it's key for me personally, what I learned quite early on in my career, to stay off those sort of platforms, you know, the message boards, etc. Okay, they can boost you, but they can also zap you very easily. So I think for me personally, I've always tried to stay off them. Otherwise, yeah, as I said before, it can definitely ruin your day quite quickly.
When you were starting
you
out...
You need to take a leaf out of this book, Max.
I quite like the abuse.
When you were starting out, obviously, you know, what were your aspirations? You know, when you're sort of 14, 15, 16, are you thinking, I'm going to play for England, I'm going to play in the Premier League?
My first aspiration was just to step foot on the Loftus Road football pitch. That was always my dream. I joined QPR Academy at 10 years old, and I didn't really look any further than that. And then after that, next goal, I wanted to play as high as possible. I didn't really set myself, I want to play for England or anything like that. It's just to play as high as possible, which was in the end Championship football. But I'm grateful for everything I've got. I played my 500th game against Northampton in Checker Trade Trophy. As you said, one man and his dog. It wasn't how I pictured it would be. But every game, I've just always just gone out there and I'm grateful for what I've got. And I know how many kids want to do what I do.
Marcus, you made that eagerly awaited debut for QPR. Tell the listeners how it went.
Not very well, let's say that. Actually, it was against Wickham of all teams. Big Andy Rammel. I don't know if anyone remember him. Remember?
Big old dirty target man.
Big dirty target man. Huge. So come on, within 4 or 5 minutes, got in a little grapple with him, kind of handbags kind of thrown each other around a little bit. Referees come over, red card, both got sent off. This is 4 minutes into my debut. I've gone into the change room. I'm there basically nearly crying, thinking this is me finished now. I'm never going to play again. But I was really fortunate. Ian Holloway at the time came in and said, listen, these things happen. And Andy Rammel's a P-R-I-C-K. So don't worry about it.
Have you spoken to Andy Rammel since?
No, I've never seen him again. That's what I think.
Well, surprise! There's one thing I've always thought about being a footballer, actually, at any level. But most of us in our sort of 20, formative years, in our teens, in our 20s, we sort of stay in one place, we sort of have the same friends, and we sort of slowly sort of learn about life. If you're a footballer, for example, 2006, you're at Blackpool, right? And you went to Rotherham on loan. And you're sort of sitting in Blackpool, and you get called into a room and someone says, you go into Rotherham and you have no choice to say, do you know what, I don't really want to go. Do you mind if I don't go to Rotherham?
I'm just thinking, like, it's possibly the only place on the planet that's worse than Blackpool.
You said it, not me.
But you know, that idea that you're at one club and then suddenly, you know, they just call you in and say, you've got to move to the other end of the country. It doesn't matter what your life situation is, your family situation, your kids and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest and the hardest part of being a footballer is the moving away from home. I was 21 when I went to Blackpool, 4 hours away from home, on my own, no family. It was dark times for me. I wasn't playing at the time. And I actually made the decision to myself, if I didn't get a club back in London after my two years at Blackpool were done, I would have probably quit. So Brentford came in for me. I was lucky. The rest is history. But I think now I'm only just kind of figuring it out with this whole drive we have on mental health and mental issues that we've got, that I probably was at that time, had a bit of depression.
And it's interesting you say that, because there must be so many young players who are leaving home, who are struggling with all the things that anyone in their early 20s struggles with, but they're doing it in such a sort of foreign environment to most people.
Yeah, it's very tough. And I think clubs have got a little bit of responsibility to really help players settle in and make sure that their mental well-being is looked after. Luckily, fortunately, now I think at 33, 34, I am now 34, I think it'd be easy for me. But at 21, it's tough. It's not easy.
And I presume in that environment as well, you can't, if you're lonely or depressed or, you know, things aren't working out, you can't show any sign of weakness either, because it will, well, you just can't.
No, you can't. I think back then, we're talking about 13 years ago, I think then it would have been frowned upon. I don't think managers and clubs and players really understood a lot about it. But I think now, with the drive that we've got and highlighting these issues, I think it's a lot more, you know, I think players have got more confidence now about going to tell the manager, I don't feel great.
So if a young player came up to you now, you know, you hear that in the dressing room, are, you know, they look after you, the old players look after you. Is that, if a young player came to you and said they were feeling that, has that ever happened?
It's happened recently, really recently. At Wickham, I'm not going to say names, obviously, but I've been approached and I've sent them in the right direction and told them where they can get help, and they're seeking help, which is great. And I think that's, as a senior player, I think it's my responsibility when people do come along that I am able to put an arm around them and help them.
On the other hand, how did you explain to Adebayo Akinfenwa that you weren't going to come in on Mondays anymore?
A very easy question, easy one with him, because he doesn't come in Mondays himself.
Are you serious?
Yeah, no, Bayo turns up when he wants, to be honest. No one's going to tell him any different, are they?
Has he ever, you know, in training, you know, you train with him, has he ever landed on you? You know, just like in a challenge or anything. Just wonder if you go up for something. At some point, he must have, you know, because he's a big lad.
He's a big lad, and you stay away from him. That, the key to playing Bayrak in Fenway is don't get in any sort of physical confrontation with him, or you're going to lose. So it's kind of, you've got to be smart, try and nick in front of him. But I've gone shoulder to shoulder with him, and it's ended very badly for me.
It's interesting for him, isn't it? Because his profile is so much higher, right, than the rest of, pretty much the rest of League One and League Two. He's obviously a lovely, right, he's lovely, right, we know that. I just wonder if there's any sort of jealousy of, you know, the love that people have for him and him being in FIFA and all that kind of stuff.
It's almost impossible to be anything but positive about the man. You, obviously, you know him yourself, met him plenty of times. His enthusiasm is just infectious, so you can't hate on him. And he's not big time at all. I played with him, I've known him for, 13 years. I was at Swansea with him, and he's the exact same person he was then, despite all the fame. We went on holiday to Canada together, Toronto, and he's getting people coming up to him, random people from all over the world come up to him wanting his autograph, etc. And he's the same guy he is now.
Do you have to take photos for...
Yeah. I'm his personal cameraman.
I have to do that with Max.
Nothing like
soul destroying.
It is, isn't it? It's horrible. I'm basically a personal cameraman on holidays. Yeah.
I didn't realise you hated it so much, Barry. Now it gives me real pleasure. You started your own podcast, Two Pros in a Pod with Hogan and Ephraim. Who left Wickham the same year you joined.
Yeah.
What's the idea behind it?
Oh, it's kind of spawned from our conversations in the dressing room. Us two would argue about football relentlessly, annoy the other boys who got bored of hearing us. So I thought, let's get on a podcast together. He's a great guy. He's got an encyclopedic knowledge of Man United and Premiership football. I kind of bring a bit of balance to it with a lower league. I really enjoy doing it.
And he's got an interesting story as well, hasn't he? He sort of fell out of love with the game.
Yeah, Hogan is a very, very talented footballer. And as he came down the leagues, I think he just got frustrated playing with players that weren't of his level. Which I tell him all the time is nonsense. You know, if you're 27, 28, you've got to keep playing football, and he just fell out of love with it.
And what's the plan for you, do you think, after playing, or how long do you think you're going to carry on?
I'm not too sure how long I'm going to carry on, but I've got ambitions to stay in the game, in the kind of technical director of football kind of role. That's my ambition. So I'm doing various courses, etc., trying to get myself qualified in a sense, and in researching bits and bobs, and that's the route I kind of see myself.
Do you feel the legs? Do you feel as fit as you ever have, or do you feel yourself slowing down?
I feel great when I'm on the pitch. I think for me, it might be personally, and other senior pros I speak to, it's the more recovery side of things, as you probably know yourself when you play on a Saturday.
Well, I was about to say, Max is, I can see he's meandering slowly towards asking you if you think it's time for him to quit, because Max keeps telling me every Sunday, he's having a, basically the only reason Max is still in his team is because he does all the admin, and he's handy to have around in that regard.
I was telling Marcus before the pod, a centre midfielder who died for a penalty for Alexandra Park at the weekend. He was a very good player, and I was giving him some chat, which was stupid because we were 5-3 down. I was just telling him how good his balance was, and it was a surprise that he just fell over, happened to fall over in the box, and he turned to me and he said something like, Just go home and look after your family, old man. Like, that was deep. That is like the deepest chat you can ever give him. And he was absolutely right. So you think you'd stay in that? You wouldn't want to go management, though. You'd want to go.
No, yeah, I prefer the stepping and kind of overseeing things. I think I can really bring something at that level. Yeah.
And is that because management just looks too stressful?
I think management now, as you see, is you get sacked after 6 months and your first job as a manager and you're finished. It's kind of, there's no continuity. And I think in order to bring my kind of ideas and philosophies on the game, you need time. And I think in that role, I can implement something and make a difference.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I think in Britain especially, it's taken quite a long time to come round to the idea that a director of football model might be acceptable. I think really clubs like Swansea and Southampton have shown that makes sort of sense, because I suppose we've seen a little bit of it with Manchester United in the transfer window. Now, they don't really have that system, but on the other hand, the people who hold the purse strings have come to the point where it's like, well, maybe we don't give this coach who's playing for his short-term future all the money in the world and get lumbered. The next coach doesn't get lumbered with loads of players that the coach doesn't want. I mean, it's not really a sustainable way to run, especially when there's so much money in English football nowadays, even at League One level, really.
No, I completely agree. I think you need continuity. And if you look at, I think Man City brought in the Barcelona backstream staff. They started buying players that played a certain way even before Guardiola came in. And I think when Guardiola leaves, they will continue to do the same thing. I think football now is just, there is no patience, etc. You need continuity. And I think a director of football kind of moulds and brings it all together.
Paul Baker writes, as Sunderland saved a penalty at home for the first time since 1989, what is the next unlikely footballing achievement that needs breaking? You can think about that and answer below the line. But a 1-1 draw at home to Fleetwood, Barry. Would Sunderland fans have wanted to beat Joey Barton's Fleetwood?
I suspect they would. I was kind of disappointed in that result. And even though I quite like Joey Barton, I still would have relished seeing his team get a good thrashing, you know, just because he's that kind of pantomime villain.
You're not still unbeaten at home, Baz, though?
I think so, yes.
I mean, that's all right, isn't it? Yeah, how does it feel being in a division where like you can win and stuff?
It's quite enjoyable. It's been a while, you know. And I did fear that when it became apparent they were going to be relegated and there was no sign that the club was going to be sold, I genuinely feared that they could conceivably get relegated again, but they look to steady the ship, and the new manager Ross seems to know what he's doing. He certainly talks a good game anyway, and they're doing all right.
Pleased to have a team like Sunderland in League One?
I think it's great for the league, yeah. Obviously, the way fans they're going to bring to a place like Wickham is great financially and also for the atmosphere. I think Sunderland have started quite well. I think they've recruited well in the summer. I think they've, seems like the new backroom, sorry, so the new owners have got a plan, which they didn't have under, was it Ellis Short? So I think times are going to be good for Sunderland moving forward.
Sunderland Fleetwood both in the playoff spaces, along with Barnsley and Walsall. Above them, devastatingly, Peterborough are top still. So annoying. After a late winner at Southend, they won 3-2, two clear of Portsmouth, who were held at home by Shrewsbury. Can you do me a favour, Marcus? And have you played Peterborough yet?
Not yet, no.
Okay, smash them when you do. Shrewsbury themselves are third bottom. They still haven't won a game. They've drawn four, though. They're one place ahead of Oxford. Plymouth are bottom and pointless in League Two. The mighty Cambridge were robbed again, losing 2-1 at home to Carlisle. Carlisle up to fourth, same points as third place. Exeter, who smashed Harry Kewell's new side, Notts County, 5-1. They're still on just 1 point. 3 points above Exeter are Lincoln and Newport. They're first and second, both on 16 points. Fitbar, Barry. Sutton, Boreham, Wood, and some Northern Irish teams trying their luck at Fitbar.
Yeah, the Scottish Challenge Cup has an interesting format. It's kind of like the Johnson's Paint Trophy, I suppose, for teams outside the Premier League, plus Premier League under 21 teams, plus a selection of teams invited from Wales, Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and the Highland Leagues. So it's a real ragbag assortment of different clubs participating. Coleraine from Northern Ireland beat former team on penalties. Sligo Rovers from the Republic beat Livingston. Boreham Wood entertained Dunfermline and lost, which is probably a good thing because Boreham Wood's chairman seemed to think they were playing in the actual Scottish Cup and said he was looking forward to possibly, you know, getting to the final at Wembley. So he didn't appear to know what competition they were in. Sutton United beat Airdrie. Their fans had an 844-mile road trip. Queen of the South, in the game of the round, they went 4-0 up against Crusaders from Norn Iron. Crusaders got it back to 4-3 with 5 minutes to go, but couldn't quite find an equaliser. And Stephen Dobby is...
Oh, yes, he is.
Banging them in for Queen of the South. He's now scored 20 in 11 games this season, which is quite a remarkable record.
Jake says, what do you make of the reformed Women's League? In particular, it now having to be fully professional. The sad story of Doncaster Rovers Bells. It was, when the whole change happens, there were some definite winners and some definite losers, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. And to see Doncaster Bells not make the cut is just unbelievable, really, I suppose, in the given what they've added to the history of women's football in this country. I suppose the argument on the other side would be, even though women's football in England has made some leaps over the past couple of years, and you've seen where Manchester City and Chelsea have got in the Women's Champions League, they've still got a way to catch up with notably Lyon in France, who are the best team out there. And I think the German teams as well, when you look at the backing, the infrastructure, the money. I mean, obviously a lot of people as well are interested in how Manchester United are doing because, you know, it's their first year.
Mm, it is their first year, and they beat Aston Villa 12-0. Jess Sigsworth got 5. Lauren James, Kirsty Hansen, 2 each for Casey Soni's side. Arsenal beat Liverpool 5-0. And Man City drew 0-0 with Chelsea in the meeting of last season's top two. Just to explain what happened with Doncaster, there was a restructuring. Doncaster Rovers Bells dropped out of the league at the same time as Sheffield FC, both for financial reasons. Doncaster released a statement to say they'd made the decision to leave the structure to, quote, ensure the continued viability and regrowth of the club. They're currently bottom of the Women's National League Premier Division. Naught goals scored, conceded 16 in their first 3 games, lost all their players, basically. And that's obviously a result of what's happened here. So sad times for Doncaster Rovers Bells. Some goodbyes. Adam says, does Marcus Bean enjoy Mr. Bean? If so, what did he think of the 2 feature-length movies in comparison to the TV show? Bloated missteps or works of genius?
Mr. Bean's a bane of my life, to be honest, so I don't watch it, never watched it, never will.
So any time you made a mistake, the headline would be...
Yeah,
oh, right.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry for bringing it up. This is from Max. How can Chris Kamara be the voice of Domino's and Papa John's? It's a very important point. And in fact, I thought I'd been offered the Papa John's gig and then I lost out.
Well, would you be able to be the voice of Gaviscon and the voice of Papa John's? Because if someone has a really spicy pizza and it starts repeating on them, the drink Gaviscon, you're having a huge
I think that I could do influence. That. I just, you know, I couldn't do Gaviscon and Pepto-Bismol, could I? You know, that's what Kamara's doing here, isn't it? Mark McBride says, where has Marcus been? Could also double as a new radio feature on our show. We're looking to fill content on our radio show. We've got an extra hour, Marcus. Would you like to do a minute every Sunday?
A minute every Sunday, I'm in.
Okay, we can do that. Bradley Wiggins will host that bit. Barry, you say you've got a reasonably amusing email to finish the show with.
Well, Nathan in Hackney has been in touch to say, hi all, Robert Earnshaw's tweet alluding that extraterrestrials would primarily send technology to Earth rather than beings seemed to be treated with high regard on the last show. However, I treat this as recycled propaganda from the first Transformers movie released in 2007. Near the end of the movie, Sam Witwicky, the chosen human ally to the Autobots, arrives at a top secret department inside the Hoover Dam where government agents indicate that much of today's technology, such as the microwave and mobile phone, derives from alien fragments descending from early Transformers which arrived on Earth from the Roswell UFO incident in the 1940s. If Earnshaw's insight into extraterrestrial activity is deemed accurate, then he's probably spent his weekend hastily rewatching the rest of the Transformers movies in preparation for his next groundbreaking tweet.
Thank you so much for that email.
And I could only pity Robert Earnshaw if he's had to spend his whole weekend watching that tripe.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Barry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Andy Brassel, thank you.
Many thanks.
Marcus Bean, good luck for the rest of the season. Thank you. We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.